And a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Christian Yeo. In the next 60 minutes, we discuss the appointment of Brazil's first ambassador to Iraq in more than 20 years. And we find out how the thirst for high-definition content is forcing Hollywood to turn to the real world for locations, to the delight of lonely landlords in London. And we pop to the local ribbon shop in our Meet the Neighbours series, and we discuss the race to Euro 2012 and how Ukraine and Poland are readying themselves for one of the biggest football tournaments in the world. All that to come in the next hour on Midori House with me, Christian Yeo. First, though, let's get the latest news from around the world with Vaughan Savage.
Monocle 24 News at 1800 hours. I'm Vaughan Savage. Syrian authorities have handed over the bodies of two journalists killed 10 days ago, American Mary Colvin and French photographer Remy Oshlik. They're being taken by ambulance from Homs to Damascus. They were both killed on February the 22nd during an intense bombardment of the Baba Amro district of Homs, a stronghold of rebels fighting President Bashar al-Assad. The Red Cross told Syria today it was unacceptable that its aid convoy had been prevented from entering Baba Amro, where the opposition said the Syrian army had committed a massacre. The Red Cross said its convoy had reached the bombarded area, which has been under siege for 26 days, but was not allowed to enter. At the same time, French Foreign Ministry spokesman Bernard Vallereau thanked the Syrians who helped wounded French journalists Edith Bouvier and William Daniels escape the city of Homs.
Because it was very dangerous, they were risking their life at any moment, and it's because of their sacrifice, if I can put it that way, that our two journalists had been able to get safe in Lebanon.
Spain has set itself a softer budget target for 2012 than originally agreed under the Eurozone's austerity drive, putting a question mark over the credibility of the European Union's new fiscal pact. Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy insisted he was acting within EU guidelines because the plan was still to hit the European Union public deficit goal of 3% of gross domestic product. At a meeting in Brussels today, 25 of the 27 European Union leaders signed a German-driven fiscal compact treaty designed to enforce EU deficit cutting and debt reduction rules more strictly. The number of women represented in parliaments around the world is worryingly low after the global average inched forward only half a percentage point in 2011 to 19.5%. A report from a global organisation of parliaments says strong political will and adoption of specific measures is needed to break the deadlock on women's political participation. China's heir apparent, the current Vice Premier Xi Jinping, is in focus as the country holds its annual parliament session next week. Willie Lam, former China editor of the South China Morning Post, says there may be changes when he comes to power.
The common goal within the leadership is that China should achieve the status of a superpower within 1 to 2 decades. And we must remember that Xi Jinping's major power base is in the People's Liberation Army. So it's quite possible that the generals might have a bigger say on foreign and security-related policy in the coming decade. And this means perhaps a heightened sense of confrontation with the US.
Some 166 wolves have been killed in Montana in the United States' first hunting season since federal protection of the species was lifted last year. But its population still managed to grow by 15% last year, according to state wildlife officials. Montana established a quota of 220 wolves for a hunting season that began in September 2011 and was extended to February the 15th this year. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Vaughan. We'll have a look at the front pages of the Asia-Pacific news in a second. But first, let's get the world weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
In Europe, the business week ends on a sunny note. In Italy, the south of France, Switzerland and the Alps, it's been like it for a few days now. If you're wondering what weather is heading to Western Europe this weekend, well, it's rain clouds, but there will be some sunshine too. Here's the weekend city outlook. And in London, around 9 degrees with occasional rain. Zurich 13, partly cloudy. Lyon 14 degrees with some sunshine. And in Rome, a mild 16, mostly sunny here. North America and the start of the weekend from the Great Lakes to the northeast of the United States. Wet, windy with snow in places. The snow mainly across the border in Quebec and Ontario though. Friday will also bring thunderstorms, even a risk of tornadoes to the Mississippi, Tennessee and Kentucky most at risk. Good news is the end of the weekend is looking much brighter. The weekend city outlook then, in Montreal, 0 degrees and snow. New York City, 13 Celsius with sunshine by Sunday. Washington, D.C., temperatures up and down, 20 on Saturday, 12 on Sunday, showers here. And in Atlanta, 14 degrees, also a showery weekend. A quick look at other world destinations. If you're off to Hong Kong, some warm weather over the coming days, around 25 degrees, but often cloudy here, with a chance of some rainstorms. In Kuala Lumpur, the usual tropical weather, 31 degrees and afternoon thundershowers. In Japan, the weather continues to be very mixed. If you're heading there early next week, bad weather may delay flights in and out of Tokyo. That's all from me. Have a good weekend, whatever the weather. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Tomas. Let's get a look at the time. It's 6 minutes past the hour here at Midori House in London. Now, looking at the newspapers, the Saturday Age of Australia. Well, most of the papers of Australia still talking about Bob Carr's appointment as the new foreign minister for Julia Gillard and that U-turn that she went about at the last minute in giving Mr. Carr the job, and much to the anger of the Defence Minister, Stephen Smith, who had originally stepped aside when Rudd was offered the position. Once Rudd had left, he had assumed it was his, which Gillard had agreed to initially, but by Thursday she decided she wanted her man. And that is what The Age says. Gillard gets her man. And we also look at the Sydney Morning Herald, which touts its list of the winners and losers from Gillard's reshuffle. So the Australian media obviously paying close attention to the wranglings of the Labour Party in the Cabinet. Also on the front of The Age, Docklands Kennett was almost giving the land away. This is a reference to the Kennett government and its sale of land very cheaply in Melbourne's Docklands area. It's claimed chunks, or documents and sales contracts obtained by The Age claim that chunks of inner-city harbourside real estate, which now houses the Harbour One Tower, a prestigious property that goes for quite a lot these days, sold for as little as $119,000 Australian dollars. It was all part of an effort back in 1999 to kickstart the Docklands project and the precinct that now sits there. Melbourne University architecture professor Kim Dovey's quoted in The Age as saying that it was timing was imperative. They wanted to kickstart the project in a hurry. But a spokesperson from the Department of Planning and Community Development insists that the sale of any government land is always overseen by an independent valuer to ensure the best value for the public purse. So, and one last one, let's have a look at the Weekend Press of New Zealand. Forever Lost, a very striking picture, beautiful one at that, of the Christchurch Cathedral as it was in 2008 before it was badly damaged by the Christchurch earthquake. Bishop Victoria Matthews has made one last personal plea to save the cathedral, and Christchurch Mayor Bob Parker, both of those trying to do something with the site. Still a lot of disagreement whether it should be flattened or restored. Obviously restoring it will cost quite a lot, but the picture on the press really illustrates why there is such disagreement over it. It's such a beautiful building. There was also some plans to turn the centre of land around the cathedral into a beachside area, an artificial beach at that in the city, and that's now been blocked by residents, and that was another plan to try and save the cathedral as it sit right in front of it. Could be flattened now, could be turned into flats, or we'll have to see. It's 9 minutes past six now, and we're going to be back in a second to talk about the new Brazilian ambassador in Iraq. We'll be back in a moment.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, e eu que sou.
Tema on Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. Now, Brazil has dispatched its first ambassador to Iraq since 1991. Former musician turned diplomat Anaret Nahes has dedicated his last 15 years of his career to the Middle East. He says he's ready for quite a tricky job. He arrived in Baghdad yesterday. Brazil has been without an ambassador in Iraq since the early 90s, although it never officially closed its embassy. Relations were handled in Jordan until 2006, eventually transferring back to Baghdad, but without a figurehead. So could this be the start of a blossoming relationship between the two countries? Joining me on the line is Marcelo Nino, the Jerusalem correspondent for Folha de São Paulo. How are you, Marcelo, firstly?
I'm fine, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, it's lovely to have you here. Now, let's go straight into it. Since the Gulf War, Venezuela was the only country to have an ambassador in Iraq until now. Why has Brazil taken so long to put somebody back there?
Well, it's mainly business. Brazil has been away from Iraq since 1991 because of political reasons and security reasons. And now they want to get their share of the contract, of the very big contracts in Iraq for the building of the country. So this is the main reason, actually.
So there was interest from Brazilian big players in the economy to invest in Iraq. What was stopping them up until now? Was it security concerns?
It was security concerns, but also political concerns. I talked to the ambassador, the new ambassador to Iraq, last week, and he told me clearly that they wouldn't send an ambassador there while Iraq was still occupied. You know, President Lula, the former president of Brazil, and now the president now is the same party, and they didn't accept. They voted against the invasion and the attack in Iraq. They were very against it. So it was a political position not to have an ambassador there. So now that with the withdrawal of the troops, they are ready to make business again in Iraq.
Let's look at the historic links between Brazil and Iraq, because it's something of a long-standing relationship, and it's gone over a few humps recently, if we look at the last 20 years. But have they been trading partners in the past?
Indeed. Actually, it's a very interesting relation between Brazil and Iraq. It started in the 70s, when Brazil was under a military dictatorship and with a large dependency on foreign oil, imports of oil. And Brazil reached in some point 60% of the oil used imported by Brazil was imported from Iraq. But it wasn't only oil. Brazil started to trade the oil that was imported from Iraq, sending very big companies to build railroads and roads and everything. They build a lot of things in Iraq, and also exporting cars and food. So it was a very large trade relation between Brazil and Iraq. And even they had in the 80s they had even a cooperation in the nuclear, a very controversial nuclear cooperation with the nuclear Iraqi program. So it was a very intense relationship.
In the build-up to the climax of the conflict in Iraq, many countries lost engineers that were in Iraq at the time, and Brazil has its own tragedy, doesn't it? How is the feeling in Brazil? Is it still quite a raw subject?
Yes, I think that Brazil has many companies, big companies in the Gulf, mainly in Dubai and Doha, and they are starting to be interested in making a business in Iraq, but they are very careful about this possibility, mainly because of this case of this engineer, Brazilian engineer, that was killed in 2005 in a terror attack and about 200 kilometers from Baghdad. And also, there were some unpaid debts during Saddam Hussein's government. So for these reasons, I think that they'll be very careful to go back to Iraq.
And before they send, you know, lots of people there to strike up these business relationships, there will be a focus on security and also at this embassy as well. When we're dealing with an ambassador, security really can't be a cut price. And in Baghdad, it's going to cost the Brazilian government quite a lot to protect their ambassador. This looks like it'll be the most expensive embassy for Brazil. Is that right?
Yeah, it's the most expensive security apparatus of all the Brazilian embassies.
Who's paying for that?
Who's paying for that is the Brazilian government. Yeah, the Brazilian government is investing that in the security in this new embassy. It's actually a complex that will be also the home of the diplomats. So they are sending the ambassador and some young diplomats to be there, I think three or four. And I don't think it was very easy to convince those diplomats to go there, but it's there in the beginning of their career. So I think they have some incentives to go there.
Is this a job for the Iraqi army then to protect these staff, or will Brazil send some of its own security forces there?
Not yet. In the beginning, Brazil was thinking about sending some of its soldiers to do the security of the embassy, but they concluded that it would be better to do it with a combination of security of Iraqi soldiers and a private company, a British private company called Aegis. So for now, they are not sending Brazilian soldiers.
When we're looking at the trade links then and the potential for Iraq and Brazil, it's quite a good combination. Brazil, there's a lot of optimism in at the moment, and Iraq really is at a stage of rebuilding, and it's resource heavy. Moving forward, will it be one of your stronger links? Will it be one of Brazil's most lucrative trading partners, or do you foresee other countries moving in on Iraq now as well?
Yes, if you ask what areas Brazil could invest, there is mainly building and infrastructure. Brazil could sell airplanes to Iraq. Brazil has a very big company, Embraer, one of the biggest of the world. They have a bus company that is based in now in has an office in Dubai. So these areas are the focus of the embassy now. They want to attract those companies to invest in Iraq.
So all eyes will be on this embassy to make sure it's a success, and then I'm sure business will follow. Marcelo, thank you very much for your time. That was Marcelo Nino, the Jerusalem correspondent for Folha de São Paulo. It's 17 minutes past the hour here, and to set us on now with a Brazilian theme, this is Água de Beber by Antonio Carlos Jobim. Água de Beber by Antonio Carlos Jobim. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Its most visible sign of economic hard time, office and retail space standing empty. Even in the CBDs of the world's biggest cities, commercial properties lay vacant, begging for a new lease of life. And in some cases, Hollywood comes knocking. With the advent of HD, film studios are under pressure to find realistic locations for shoots. Mocked-up streets with full stalls and windows just won't do anymore. Now landlords are touting their empty shells as the perfect alternative to the traditional film set. Firstly, to bring in some cash. Secondly, to give their building notoriety. I'm joined by Mark Hughes-Webb, Managing Director of Space 2, a company which helps landlords find these glittering tenants. Mark, how are you?
Very well, Christian. How are you?
Not too bad. Now, firstly, I'm curious, does it pay well to have these film studios come in and take over your building?
It can pay very well. It's certainly a better option than keeping it empty for a number of reasons. The money in itself is very, very useful. The location fees range from anything from a couple of £1,000 a day up to maybe £5,000 to £7,000 a day. And if you're going to be a location for a longer period of time. For a feature film, for example, they may need the space for up to a month. It can certainly contribute quite a nice sum to the bottom line of any annual income that the building would otherwise bring in.
And I'd imagine it's quite a diverse range of properties they're looking for, because it all depends on the film that they're planning.
Very much so, and you know, it's not just even a case of filming the location as the physical city it's in. Recently, London was shot as Paris for the film Bellamy that's coming out at the moment. So, I mean, the diversity that any city offers really is the key, and London in particular has about as diverse an architectural sort of heritage as you're going to find within an urban environment. So you've got everything from incredible heritage properties all the way through to literally the most stunning of skyscrapers and everything in between.
I mentioned when I was introducing you that the need for these realistic, these authentic sets, and with the advent of high definition, that's all the more apparent. But from a production company's perspective, is it cheaper to rent actual properties than build sets in the professional studios you see at Elstree or in Hollywood?
It can be. The cost element is obviously based around how much control and how much time they may need on location. If you're going to be using a location for a very long period of time, it may make sense to build that as a set on a backlot if it's an exterior at a studio, or in a studio environment at somewhere like Pinewood. It comes down to a fine balancing act. It's certainly not cheap. The craftsmen and tradesmen who do the set builds are incredibly talented individuals, and the cost of doing that may well be offset if they need the set available for a long period of time. Location filming has its drawbacks, there's no doubt about it, particularly in big city centres where, you know, parking is a big issue. If you take a couple of recent big Hollywood movies, they were carrying somewhere in the region of sort of 30 trucks, and you could have anywhere up to 100 or so cars just for the crew in support of that. So, you know, there's some practical and logistical issues as well as the cost benefits to be weighed up as well of shooting on location.
Mark, can you name drop and give us some of the bigger films that you've handled now and put in touch with landlords?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've had quite a flurry of interesting Hollywood projects recently, and it certainly illustrates the diversity. When we've done recently Batman, we did a big stunt sequence where a building, an empty office building in Croydon of all places, which is a suburb of London, was the sort of double for Gotham City, and that's in the for the movie that's coming out next.
I remember that caused quite a stir amongst Croydonians. It was all over the internet on Twitter. People were making comments of finding it odd that a Batman film was being shot in Croydon of all places.
Absolutely. I mean, the great thing about Hollywood is it doesn't necessarily take into account people's perception of a physical area. They're very much focused on the location, and that was a situation where Croydon certainly benefited from the fact that it had a certain style of building that, to be honest, you probably wouldn't find anywhere else in the country. So that's where it certainly appeals. More recently, we've done some interesting filming for the new Bond movie using a building which is actually being refurbished almost at the same time that we've been doing the filming in it. So that's posed some huge operational challenges for both the developer and for the production company. But the building is a very iconic one in central London, and you know, once a Hollywood director sets their heart on something, they tend to get what they want. Certainly not the easiest of locations, but hopefully on screen it will look the part.
Do some landlords come to you and start off with a short-term aim just to fill that vacancy before they find a permanent tenant, but then eventually see the merit in having these types of clients in their buildings and maintain that use for the media?
Commercially, it doesn't ever really stack up. The money that filming will provide will never replace commercial rent. What we have seen, though, is a change in the way that landlords will try and accommodate these slightly more creative businesses, as it were. So even where we've had new developments where the building has become fully occupied, but that hasn't stopped us carrying on using the building as a location, albeit with the restrictions of, you know, we only can use perhaps the exterior of the building, the reception, the rooftop, And other areas that maybe aren't seen, so things like underground car parks are always at the forefront of anyone doing a gangster movie. So underground car parks obviously are vacant at weekends for office buildings. So we've managed to create a very sustainable sort of attitude to that so that landlords can carry on with the benefit of generating some additional income. But crucially, the film industry can benefit from the great locations even once the building is fulfilling its original purpose.
Mark, thank you for that. We must leave it there. Mark Hughes-Webb, the Managing Director of Space 2, which helps landlords find film clients to take over their properties. We're going to go to a song now. This is Islands by the XX. That was Islands by the XX. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll be hearing about football's Euro 2012 tournament and what it means for Ukraine and Poland. And as always, on Friday, we'll be meeting the neighbours. But first, here's the news with Vaughan Savage.
Thank you. Syrian authorities have handed over the bodies of two journalists killed 10 days ago, American Mary Colvin and French photographer Remy Oschlik. They're being taken by ambulance from Homs to Damascus. The Red Cross told Syria today it was unacceptable that its aid convoy had been prevented from entering Baba Amro, which has been under siege for 26 days. Spain has set itself a softer budget target for 2012 than originally agreed under the Eurozone's austerity drive, putting a question mark over the credibility of the European Union's new fiscal pact. Iranians have voted in a parliamentary election likely to reinforce Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei's power over rival hardliners led by President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. The number of women represented in parliaments around the world is worryingly low after the global average inched forward only half a percentage point in 2011 to 19.5%. And that's the news at the bottom of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Vaughan. In a second, we'll be speaking to Monocle's Section E editor, Santiago Tadditi. He'll be telling us what he got up to in New York City.
London, as a Monocle who's on need.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, es ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, este es Monocle 24.
London, cala, Monocle 24 des.
De Londres, es ist Monocle 24.
London ist, sind Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λόντος, τέμα ον, Monocle 24.
Λόντζαν, μπουρασε, Monocle 24.
Λόντον καλά, Monocle 24.
Welcome back. It's 31 minutes past the hour here at Midori House. And welcome, Santiago.
Hey, Christian. How are you?
I'm very well. I haven't seen you for a while.
I know. I've been traveling for the past 2 weeks.
Yeah, your suitcase must be worn out.
It's okay. I got wheels.
Don't worry. It's okay then. How was New York City?
It was very good. It was very fun. I went there with the Monocle team. We had our anniversary party there.
Was any work done whilst you were there?
A lot of work.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah, of course.
Especially, well, since, you know, I work in the food and drinks section of the magazine.
It's
Somebody's had to go around the city and try a lot of restaurants and drinks and meet people and so on.
Hidden treasures that you can spoil and tell us all about?
Well, not that hidden, to be honest. Most of these places are already known in the city. It's just that I hadn't been to New York in a while, exactly 5 years, because I've been focusing on Europe lately. And you know, well, we have Aisha there who does pretty much all the work in the States.
What struck you about it? Has it changed much in the past 5 years?
Well, I stayed in the Midtown, and that was a part I didn't explore that much. The first time I went, my first trips were mostly spent walking around Soho and NoHo and Nolita and so on, and even Chinatown. But this was I had more of a corporate feel of New York. But still a great city, amazing and incredible and overpowering at times.
And different eateries, were they all executive eateries? Or I think you went for a burger somewhere, didn't you?
I went for two burgers, actually. Well, the first day I got there, I met a friend, and We walked around the meatpacking district and went to a place called the Pop Burger.
Okay.
And had what's called a Superman burger.
Oh, I like the sound of that.
It was an 8-ounce beef burger with onions, fried onions, fried pickles, and two pieces of bacon.
Very good.
Yeah.
Did you finish it?
I did. I did. Yeah, I can't stand the sight of an unfinished burger.
No,
so I had to. And well, after that, you can imagine I was pretty full. So next day I skipped breakfast. But then I met with Marcus Hippie, our radio producer, and we were walking around. We didn't know where to go. So I recommend Dina Di Luca. We just Googled it. And the nearest one was in the New York Times building. That building is fairly new, and it's one of my favorite buildings. I love it, and there's something about the New York Times logo that is extremely alluring.
Mm-hmm.
So we went in there and had just like a salad still.
You were still full from
still
that.
Still full, yeah.
What can you do with a burger though now? I mean, there's been every combination tried. Was there anything different about this burger, or was it just the size?
Well, actually, it's the first time I've had deep fried pickles.
Deep fried
in the burger.
Yeah, that's a new one to me as well. Deep fried pickles.
Yeah, well, they're battered and then fried.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think I prefer fresh pickles. Mm. The crunchiness in them. I don't know.
Keep the deep fry for onion rings.
Yeah, exactly. But another of the burgers I tried, which was also very interesting, is
did you just eat burgers?
No. But I thought that being in New York, well, you have to pay your respect to the city
and eat at least a couple
of burgers.
Yeah.
So I went to this place called The Burger Joint, and this is a hidden restaurant in the lobby of the Parker Meridian Hotel. It's been there since 2003, but not people have visited it because it hides behind a curtain in the lobby. So it's kind of difficult to find. There's only a neon sign of a burger and a small arrow pointing the entrance.
So there's the hidden gem right there.
It was very good. It's a burger that is made with only chuck beef,
right.
And it's made by two local butchers the hotel has, and they only serve this one burger and a grilled cheese sandwich for vegetarians, and well, it comes in the typical lettuce, tomato, onion combination, and with sauces. But you obviously can work your way around those combinations and order whatever you want.
But they do it well.
They do it very well. Mm. It's a quick spot. It's decorated a la Americana. So there's a lot of vintage sports posters, and everybody's been signing on the wall, including famous people. So I managed to spot the Bill Clinton signature just
oh, really?
On top of the furnace.
You nearly lost me there. If Mr. Clinton has been there, then it can't be bad.
It's definitely a popular place.
You've got to raise it a bit now. You didn't spend the whole time in burger joints, did you?
No, I actually had time to, unfortunately, I had to go to the Peninsula Spa and check that out.
Oh, unfortunately for you. Yeah, what was
that
like?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to say, it was great. It was a very nice place. The spa was inaugurated in 2009, and it's received a lot of accolades from many different publications and blogs and so on. And it's a great space. It has, if I'm right, 11 massage rooms, and they offer all sorts of treatments, including the usual Swedish massage, up to more fancy options like stone therapy and, you know, all these things.
I don't.
Oh, you don't?
I never get
well,
to do
we
that
We have
sort
to go
thing.
To a spa someday.
I think I just want your job, Santiago.
Well, you're welcome to come anytime.
Oh, bless you. As always, Santiago, a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Christian.
We're going to go to a song now and maintain the New York City feeling and theme here. This is Another Likely Story by Au Revoir, Simone. That was another likely story by Au revoir, Simone. In a second, we'll be popping to the shops in our weekly Meet the Neighbours series. We'll be back in a moment.
With bureaus in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York and Zurich, and over 25 correspondents around the world, Monocle has an experienced team of editors and journalists filing for us around the clock. From our bureau in Hong Kong, Liv Lewichnik covers Southeast Asia.
From Hong Kong, I cover China, Malaysia, Singapore, the Philippines and other Asian nations. And I also do stories in Australia from time to time. In Harbin, Northeast China, I visited moon robot builders and Siberian tigers. And I popped over to Penang to check out the property market in Georgetown, a place that has the feel of 1960s Singapore to it. I love working from Hong Kong. It's a regional hub for commerce and finance that is taking leaps and bounds on the international art scene. It's got some of the best restaurants and shops around, and being one of the easiest places to start a business, it's a hotspot for startups. It's a city in fast forward, which is just the way we like it.
That was Monocle's Liv Lewichnik, our woman in Hong Kong.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about making things better. Each week, I'll take you on a rollicking romp through the worlds of design, craft, architecture, fashion, and graphics, with factory frolics, building tours, product tests, and studio guests.
They're beautiful, they're functional. When you use them, they are completely poetic. They lift that activity, whatever it is, to another level. It makes you aware of the quality of what you're doing.
Tune in every week to hear the stories behind the things that we live with. That's Section D, premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 6 or 1844 here in London. If you're waking up in Auckland, it's 7:44 a.m. Now, every week at Monocle, we like to go out and meet the neighbours to get to know some of the thriving local businesses which surround Midori House. This week, we went to a ribbon shop, the Vivi Rulo shop. You can buy ribbons, you can buy tie backs, tassels, all the trimmings, or you can buy trimmings. We spoke to the manager there, Faye Eric.
My name is Faye. I work for Vivi Rulo on Marylebone Lane. I'm the manager of the shop. We have a lovely shop on Marylebone Lane, which is specialist on ribbons and trimmings, and we do headdresses. We design headdresses. We sell lovely flowers and feathers and tie backs and tassels. Every single thing, actually, that you need to prettify yourself or your house or your environment. Main sellers of the shop is actually ribbons, headdresses, flowers. We sell quite a lot of flowers. Birds, our birds are very famous. Also butterflies, actually, are all colourful and lovely. And throughout the year, I think, together with our lovely and colourful shop, they keep the spring in Marylebone throughout the year. That's why people love them, I think. Our customers are mainly women, but we do have men that comes in the shop as well that are fashion designers or interior designers that they do shop. We mainly have people who make things, actually, rather than just to buy things to, you know, to get things made. We've got quite a creative bunch of people that are coming in Vivi Rulo, and we always exchange ideas, and we like to see their portfolios and try to contribute to that. Or even a lady that is trying to change a little bit of their clothing, just, you know, decorate it or just change it and give it a different look, we're happy to help them. And we do have creative people, as I said before, that come in and, you know, change a jacket and then wear it as completely something else. We wear a headdress every day, this lovely black and gold feather flower, handmade feather flower that I'm wearing on my head now. It is really, yeah. Headdresses in general are my favourite in the shop, actually, because it's endless, limitless, you know. We have so many feathers and flowers and even birds and ribbons and everything. It's endless. If you just bring, if a customer just brings a piece of her outfit, we have no limit to make them a lovely headdress. So headdresses are in general my favorite. Yes. My favorite thing about Malibon is that we have so many specialist shops that they sell very special things that you wouldn't really be able to see anywhere else in London. Even the cafes, little cafes and, you know, shops that we have, I quite like, especially the ones on Malibon High Street are my favorite towards the end. I'm not going to give a name. I think that it's what makes Malibon lovely. It's quite a local place, so we do have so many local people that come in the shop. That is, you know, we almost feel like we have a family around Malibon with all the people. It's really good environment. I love people as well as the shops and businesses.
That was Faye Eric, the manager at Vivi Rulo, the ribbon shop in Marylebone.
This is Monaco 24.
Dette Monaco 24.
Essa é Monaco 24.
Das ist Monaco 24.
And a Monaco 24 tag, yeah.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Monaco 24 è York Sound.
Tämä on Monaco 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monaco 24.
Esto es Monaco 24.
Hasta en tu Monaco 24.
The hat at Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24. You're listening to Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Welcome back. It's 100 days until Euro 2012, and whilst football fans might be counting down the days, host countries Poland and Ukraine are still racing to ready themselves for the big event. Like the Olympics, hosting a football tournament is a strenuous undertaking, but it gives ambitious countries a chance to polish themselves to take centre stage. But the host cities, Lviv in Ukraine and Wrocław in Poland, are not 100% ready yet. They say they're close, at around 90%. In Poland, for instance, the government is hoping to smooth over the embarrassment of not opening several motorways in time by changing the laws to let traffic go on them anyway. Monocle's contributor in Kiev, Bruce Leishman, joins me on the line now. Firstly, Bruce, dirt track roads in Poland, how's Ukraine looking? Any better?
Christian, look, I think what you do have is a real tale of two countries going on here. And despite what we're hearing from Poland, I think there's no doubt that Poland really will be ready. And Poland is really trying to use this is a real branding and exercise to kind of rebrand and promote modern Poland. Ukraine is in a slightly different category, you would have to say. But things are getting done and things are working at the moment 24 hours around the clock. And it's no doubt that things will be ready and things will be on time, but we just don't know how good the finished product will be, and how we can judge, you know, how successful these things can be done long time, because there's no doubt that it is a rush job right now.
So it sounds like Poland's doing slightly better in preparation. Ukraine is playing catch up. How much pressure is there on the government in Ukraine? The public expecting big things from this. It's a now or never type solution. If they don't make full use of this event and they miss the opportunity, the government will never live it down.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why things will come together at the end. There's no doubt about that. You see that, you know, wealthy Ukrainians have been brought in to give extra financial support where necessary. And, you know, there was talk, a few years ago and up to last year of Ukraine, in fact, having their games taken away from them. And they would either be played in Poland or, in fact, other countries said that they would be ready to host. And Scotland, I think, on two occasions said they'd be ready to take over from Ukraine. And you have to, though, look back. I mean, these games, this was awarded in 2007. And, you know, if you look at where Ukraine was in 2007, it was kind of still in the afterglow of the Orange Revolution. And, you know, there was a great deal of hope about what Ukraine was going to become. I think nobody would have foreseen that in that interim period, you effectively have, the people voting in the government, that they had a revolution to ensure that wasn't elected. And no one would have really anticipated there would be probably years of fairly stagnant government under the Yushchenko-Timoshenko rule. But certainly Ukraine knows it has a lot to lose if they're not prepared, and that's why, you know, all efforts at the moment to make sure that Ukraine does present a positive picture this summer.
Let's look at the practicalities of this and the actual infrastructure in Ukraine, firstly. The venue, how is the arena in Lviv looking now? Is it, how far are we from a full completion?
Yeah, look, at the moment, it's finishing touches. You know, it has, in fact, had a soft opening. Alicia Keys was flown in and performed. And, you know, certainly on that night, the stadium was not ready. Okay, there were no operational toilets, for example. Half the seats weren't in. But you would say now that, you know, the hard product is there, but it is, you know, doing the fit out and getting the stadium ready to be, you know, to be used for the games. So, you know, the product is there. It's a new stadium. It's a good stadium. But it is these final stages. And it should have been ready by now. No doubt there's been a great deal of delays with the Lviv organisers, and there's been a huge change of personnel there just in the last 6 months and who has been had oversight over the project. So, you know, it is down though to the final stages, and, you know, and they will get it done in the next, you know, in the next 100 days.
And in terms of transport, getting people to and from venues and from the airport, what are they going to see when they land at Lviv? What's the airport situation there?
Lviv, if you went to Lviv, you know, 18 months ago and you saw Lviv Airport, you'd be quite shocked. It was a real Soviet airport, quite sweet in its own way. Obviously, you know, it was quite a Soviet airport of about two or three rooms, and you walked out to the plane, you walked in on the tarmac into a quite a sweet little building. Actually, what you'll see now is a fairly modern, you know, European terminal has been built. And that also follows. That's also taken place in Kiev, where a new terminal will open in the next few months, probably perhaps in 99 days time, but certainly before the start of the tournament. But what hasn't happened, and what was in the master plan at the beginning, was that you would be able to crisscross Ukraine on kind of, you know, fast speed trains and a modern train network. None of that is in place, and it certainly will not be in place in time for the game.
Football fans often venture into lands unknown or lesser known to follow their faithful team, and nothing like a sporting event can showcase a country. And this does seem like a race, doesn't it, between brand Ukraine, brand Poland. Is there a clear winner from this? Are they equally benefiting? It doesn't sound like they're equally as prepared.
Yeah, look, I think Poland has done a little more work to ensure their message is getting over, and that is the message that Poland is a very dynamic economy, that Poland is, you know, very much a model European, Central European nation. That's the image they want to convey, and I think they will do that successfully. And that will go, and that will dispel some of these stereotypes that still exist about Poland. We've looked at that a few times on Monocle 24. So I think that they will do a lot to dispel those types of stereotypes. Ukraine, I don't think, has such high ambitions from it, but I think ultimately people will take away, you know, a good image of Ukraine. It's going to be in the height of summer, you know, and these are football fans. And what has Ukraine got? It's got lots of pretty girls and it has cheap beer. So, you know, no doubt, I think it has a lot that the football fans will love.
If the airports and the trains and the roads don't impress, the women will. Thank you, Bruce. Thank you ever so much. That's Bruce Leishman, Monocle's contributor in Kiev. Staying with the football theme, we're going to have a song by a Spanish band. This is DeLorean, the current European champions Spain are. This song is Real Love. A That's all we have time for on this Friday edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Hannah Jenkins, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Andrew Carter. In 3 hours' time, it's time for the Monocle Daily. That's at 2200 hours London time. After the headlines with Vaughan, it's the latest edition of The Menu. I've been Christian Yeo. Goodbye.